Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden sparred over policy and traded insults in their first debate Tuesday night, just 5 weeks before the presidential election. Mike O'Sullivan reports on the combative confrontation.
A genial start to the debate, which quickly became a heated exchange over topics including COVID-19, which has claimed 1 million lives globally and more than 200,000 in the United States.
The president has no plan. He hasn't laid out anything. He knew all the way back in February how serious this crisis was.
Trump said he has led an effective response.
We got the gowns, we got the masks, we made the ventilators. You wouldn't have made ventilators, and now we're weeks away from a vaccine.
Biden blasted Trump's efforts to end the Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare, which provides health care insurance to some 20 million people. Trump said the law is unconstitutional and limits consumer choice. Biden says voters can keep their private health plans under his proposed expansion of Obamacare.
They can. They do. They will under my
The exchange quickly degenerated as each man talked over the other.
Your party, Obamacare is no good. We made it better.
Trump accusing Biden of pursuing socialized medicine. Another point of contention, Trump's choice to fill a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, left vacant by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal icon. Trump nominated conservative Judge Amy Coney Barrett, launching a confirmation process when voting has already begun in many states. Biden says whoever wins in November should fill Ginsburg's seat.
The American people have a right to have a say in who the Supreme Court nominee is.
Trump responded that it's his duty to name a replacement regardless of the timing.
We won the election and therefore we have the right to choose her.
A Trump campaign official says he's pleased with the debate.
I think what viewers saw was President Trump, who was in command of every moment of the debate. And I think they saw a weak Joe Biden, who was put on his heels most of the time, spent a lot of time looking around for assistance from the moderator.
Analysts slammed the free-for-all.
No. I'm Mr. President.
When Biden spoke, so many times he would get 10, 20, 30 seconds into a coherent point, and then he'd be interrupted over and over and over again by the president. So to ask who won the debate is almost meaningless because the president made sure there actually was no presidential debate as we have come to know them.
With round one finished, two more debates are scheduled for October. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. The world recently reached a tragic milestone of 1 million known deaths linked to COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. Experts say more testing is key to combating the virus's spread. A biotech company in Taiwan has developed a robot capable of conducting thousands of COVID tests each day, and that makes it possible to safely revive the economy. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Health experts agree that robust and rapid testing for COVID-19 is at the core of controlling the spread of the coronavirus that has ravaged the world. Now, Taiwanese biotech firm TCI says it has a solution for safety and consistency. Chief Supervisor Arvin Chen.
We designed the robotic arm action by mimicking the human action to prevent the cross-contamination. And we also have to perform the centrifugation in this station to make sure that there is no reagent residue on the well wall to make sure that the reaction performs perfectly.
The machine, made up of three robotic arms, is called the QVS-96. Designers say it mimics how humans do their jobs. Chen says the robot can quickly and consistently perform the work of well-trained technicians.
QVS-96S can produce around 2,000 results per day. With 100 QVS-96S deployed in JFK airports or Singapore airports, these airports can fully resume their flight and let the passenger travel safely and bring back country economy.
Dr. Li Shiming at the Chengshan Hospital in Taipei City welcomes the new technology that comes in time for flu season.
The machine is very accurate. It will effectively determine whether a specimen is only flu or COVID-19. This is very efficient in epidemic prevention. You will not mistakenly quarantine a flu patient, and you will not overreact by mistake.
Government agencies, Taiwan Centers for Disease Control, and three hospitals in North and Central Taiwan already use TCI's QVS-96 robot. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, with international travel almost non-existent because of the coronavirus pandemic, the global tourism industry is finding new ways to make money. In Asia, one way companies are trying to stay profitable is through so-called flights to nowhere, as VOA's Bill Gallo explains from Seoul.
It's no secret most of the world's airports have sat empty for months. But some airlines in Asia are trying to change that by offering flights that end up right where they began. It's the flight to nowhere. While it may sound like a gimmick, customers are actually buying tickets. This month, a Taiwanese airline took passengers to South Korea's Jeju Island, circled a few times, and flew right back to Taiwan. In the air, they had a Korean language and culture lesson. This passenger, 35-year-old Liu Chun-hee, says she couldn't go abroad, so her friend recommended this flight. As soon as she heard about it, she wanted to experience the flight to nowhere. The flights are not cheap. Australia's Qantas airline charged almost $800 for an economy seat on a flight that offered views of attractions such as the Great Barrier Reef. The flight sold out in 10 minutes. In Japan, the flights don't even leave the ground. An entertainment company offers flights in a fake airport cabin. Passengers get meals and tour famous sites through virtual reality headsets. Hirari Ito is a virtual flight attendant. She's never been a flight attendant in real life, and she says it was hard to learn how to become one now.
We've been changing and trying to improve every day, so I hope it will last for a long time in the long run.
The trend is a sign people are eager to be done with quarantine and other restrictions, says digital marketing analyst Ming-Ming Chen.
The problem is, if you want to travel to other countries, you have to go through all the safety procedures. You have to have your COVID-19 tested, and you need to go through quarantines. And it's really not convenient for a lot of people.
But while the flights to nowhere may provide a boost for travel companies, they don't help the broader tourist industry. Here in Seoul, many shopping districts that rely on foreigners are mostly empty, waiting for the flood of tourist dollars that may not come anytime soon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Millions of Afghans are closely watching preliminary peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban in Doha. Many are waiting to see whether the political freedoms and rights gained over the last 19 years will be protected in a future peace deal. VOA's Najiba Khalil spoke to Mohammed Naeem, a spokesperson for the Taliban's political office in Qatar via Skype, about women's rights, press freedom, as well as Taliban attacks, and filed this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
One key topic for the peace talks in Doha is the status of Afghan women's rights. In an interview with VOA, the Taliban's political office spokesperson in Qatar, Mohammed Naeem, explained the group's stance.
I must say that we have our own country, our own nation, and our own values. We cannot bring the values of other societies and impose them on our society. For example, we cannot justify women's rights on the basis of the values that exist in the United States, in Europe, and in other countries. Our nation does not want this at all. Our nation is Muslim.
Others say over the past two decades, Afghanistan's women have preserved their Islamic values while gaining new rights and opportunities.
No Afghan woman has lost her Islamic values. Every Afghan woman wants to lead her daily life, government work, and social, cultural, and political work based on Islamic and Afghan cultural values.
Washington's position on the issue remains firm, says U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad, who briefed American lawmakers this month.
I want to assure you human rights, women's rights, the rights of minorities and children, indeed all citizens of Afghanistan, but particularly women, is of the highest importance to the United States.
When they were last in power, the Taliban banned television and tightly controlled most radio. After their exit in 2001, Afghan media flourished as tens of television stations and hundreds of radio stations launched. Many journalists now worry speech rights could be in jeopardy.
Freedom of expression does not mean that someone should come in and insult the values of the nation. This is not acceptable in the United States, in Europe, or anywhere else.
The Afghan Journalist Safety Committee says the government should defend the gains the country has made toward establishing a free press.
The government prides itself on free reporting and free media. If it hurts these freedoms itself, I don't think it would have a strong argument with its rival in talks.
Civilians have paid a terrible price in Afghanistan's war. A United Nations report estimated in 2019 that more than 100,000 civilians had been killed or wounded. The Taliban maintain they have tried to avoid the casualties, even though for years the group has carried out suicide bomb attacks in densely populated markets and cities.
Everyone's interpretation is their own interpretation. The war here is not about civilian casualties. Of course, war has casualties everywhere in the world. We try very hard not to have civilian casualties. That is why we have formed a commission in our organization called the Civil Loss Prevention Commission. Civilian losses on our part are very limited.
Deputy spokesperson of Afghanistan's defense ministry, Fawad Minapal, disagrees.
In fact, it was the Taliban who increased the rate of violence and war in Afghanistan. The people of Afghanistan know that the Taliban have stepped up their terrorist attacks, from suicide attacks to bombings, and every day sacrificing the Afghan people.
Despite many differences, the Taliban are optimistic about a peace deal.
We hope that the negotiations will reach a conclusion. We are not disappointed. We hope to reach a conclusion as we reach an agreement with the Americans. It may take time. There may be problems, but we are hopeful.
The peace talks in Doha have no end date, and it remains unclear if they will come to a resolution. In the meantime, the fighting continues in Afghanistan. For Najiba Khalil in Washington, D.C., Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. New reported revelations that President Donald Trump paid little in federal taxes, along with the president's unsubstantiated allegations of mail-in voting fraud and the political battle to name a new conservative Supreme Court justice before the November election, have shifted media focus of the U.S. presidential campaign away from the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Brian Padden reports on how both Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are reacting to these issues as they are preparing for their first of three presidential debates a short time from now, and how all of this might impact the race for the White House.
President Trump on Sunday denied a New York Times report alleging that as a billionaire real estate developer, he avoided paying any federal income taxes in 10 of the last 15 years and paid only $750 in 2016 and in 2017, his first year in the White House.
Totally fake news. No, actually, I paid tax.
And you'll see that as soon as my tax returns. It's under audit. They've been under audit for a long time. The IRS does not treat me well.
Democratic candidate Joe Biden's campaign responded with an ad contrasting how little the president reportedly paid in taxes with the thousands of dollars working Americans like teachers, nurses, and firefighters pay. The new focus on taxes could put the president on the defensive as the two major presidential contenders prepare to face off in their first debate on Tuesday night in Cleveland, Ohio. Biden has tried to keep the campaign focused on what he says is Trump's failure to contain the deadly coronavirus pandemic that has caused more than 200,000 deaths nationwide. Trump has defended his administration's pandemic response and has questioned the legitimacy of mail-in voting, as polling indicates significantly more Democrats than Republicans will send in absentee ballots because of the coronavirus. In naming federal appeals court judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the Supreme Court vacancy left by the recent death of liberal justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Trump has also touted how he delivered a conservative majority court that will protect gun owner rights and restrict legal abortion. Biden and Democrats have warned their supporters that a conservative court will likely restrict women's rights, gay marriage, and overturn expanded federal health care protections.
It's no mystery about what's happening here. President Trump is trying to throw out the Affordable Care Act. He's been trying to do it for the last 4 years. The Republican Party has been trying to eliminate it for a decade.
However, analysts say the constant focus on Trump could be a disadvantage for his campaign, which has struggled to make Biden's competency an issue and portray his policies as socialist and radical.
The Trump campaign has failed in making this a choice election. They have not been able to elevate the questions around Joe Biden's candidacy and potential presidency.
Tuesday's debate will give both candidates a major opportunity to change the dynamics of the race with just weeks to go before the election. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. After a five-month delay due to the coronavirus pandemic, crowds are able to pack into the only international car show of the year in Beijing, with reduced ticket sales to lower crowd numbers. While China has been able to keep coronavirus under control, travel restrictions are still in effect. Most international executives are staying home and introducing new models over virtual presentations. As electric cars gain more and more popularity each year, the event features electric vehicles from a variety of automakers. Kent Ove Bovalan, executive chief architecture engineer of Geely's Vehicle Architecture Center, sees great future of electric vehicles.
So EV cars definitely will grow, especially when the harder regulation coming on IC cars in fuel economy.
Beijing is targeting to have a 25% adoption of energy-saving vehicles by 2025. Cars are not the only electric vehicles on display. XPeng, a Chinese electric vehicle firm, is taking the chance to show off its Kiwi Gogo, a drone-like vehicle that can carry two people. The vehicle is considered a symbol of hope for flying cars. Vietnamese lotus silk maker Phan Thai Thuan has been weaving since she was 6 years old in her village on the outskirts of Hanoi. But 3 years ago, Phan found a new opening in the lotus stems left to rot in the nearby fields after the seeds had been harvested for food. She began obtaining the fiber found in the stems to make lotus silk, an exclusive fabric highly sought after by fashion designers. Today, Phan has a team of 20 that are mostly female who break off the stems in the paddies before they remove the delicate fibers and roll them into thread.
I aim to train the young generation to do this work of making lotus silk, especially students during summer holiday, because they are intelligent, swift-handed, and creative.
Phan described the process as painstaking, as just a large scarf requires the thread of around 9,200 stems, and it would take just one worker around 2 months to finish. However, she still insists the finished product is worth it. Nian Tai Shua was taught by Phan in 2017.
To make a product from lotus silk, it requires the workers to have skills, be dexterous, and also patient.
Lotus scarves on average go for 10 times the price of a regular scarf. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria, such as E. coli and Salmonella, that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int or www.cdc.gov.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, when it comes to elections, most Americans vote in person at neighborhood polling stations. That's likely going to change in November's general election, when millions of people are expected to vote by mail, and many for the first time because of the COVID-19 pandemic. While convenient for many, what are the safeguards and risks with voting by mail? Michelle Quinn explores.
For election officials nationwide, it's time to get ready for the big event, Election Day 2020, when millions of voters decide who will be the next president. This year, voting itself presents an enormous challenge because of the pandemic. The response? Most states are greatly expanding voting by mail.
If we assume that somewhere between 65% and 75% of all ballots cast in the 2020 presidential election come by mail, that means that somewhere between 90 million and 105 million ballots might come through the mail. That's a very, very significant volume of mail.
Of course, there are numerous logistical and security challenges to voting by mail. Registering voters, for one, and then getting the right ballots to voters.
Sometimes you hear talk as if blank ballots are simply being sent out into the world almost willy-nilly, without control. And that's simply not the case.
Voters receive ballots that are specially printed for their precinct with barcodes with encoded information tied to the person's voter registration. After voting, the voter mails their ballot or takes it to a drop-off center. Then the county's voting software system goes to work. Digital scanners take images of the outside of the ballot to make sure the voter's signature on the outside matches the one the county has on file. A digital scanner scans the ballots and counting begins. Any anomaly, a missing or wrong signature, a stray mark, is sent to a team for review.
It's like a factory floor, right? They keep getting outsorted based on, I'd say it's quality control standards, because we have to look at the signature more closely.
Voters can track their ballot's progress, much like the way they can track a package being delivered via text messages or a ballot tracking app. The process is also anonymous. The ballot's envelope is separated from the actual ballot as it is being counted.
The voter's personal information and the concreteness of their reality have been physically dissociated from each other. That's a really critical step in our democracy in terms of protecting the secrecy and the privacy of the vote.
But voting by mail isn't a panacea. Not everyone who votes gets their ballots counted.
They arrive too late, or more importantly, they're postmarked too late. Or the voter didn't sign the envelope, or the signature doesn't match sufficiently the voter's signature on file.
This year, the state has extended the window for mail-in ballots. Counties must contact voters to validate their signatures if there is a problem. Even with these reforms, Alexandra worries about one group, young and new voters.
They have three strikes against them. They are unfamiliar with voting. They are not very familiar with how the U.S. Postal Service works, and they're not used to making a signature.
Racing the clock, checking voter registrations, sending mailers to get the word out about how to vote by mail. That's what election officials are doing now. Some are warning final election results may not be known for weeks. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
The advent of the smartphone has changed human behavior. Will smart glasses be the next big intelligent technology? Google tried it more than 6 years ago with the Google Glass. It did not take off largely because of privacy concerns, but companies big and small in several countries are still working on smart glasses, including Facebook. And there are also reports that Apple is working on a version. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on what's currently on the market and their varied applications.
First, there was the keyboard, then the touchscreen. Some tech companies say a wearable pair of glasses could be the next leap in technology, even if it didn't work out for Google Glass.
In the future, we won't be only limited to our smartphones when it comes to understanding the world around us. So this is our early investment in that future.
The U.S.-based company Snap's investment is this, the Spectacles 3 sunglasses. This third version is smarter than the previous ones. It has two cameras. The corner of the glasses lights up when recording video and allows the wearer to put 3D objects in the video. Here are some flowers.
Or the bird, which is really cool.
Users can capture up to a minute of video. In a very different application, the M-Glass by Hong Kong-based Pacific Future allows theme park visitors to have a different kind of experience through augmented reality. During the launch of the smart glasses during Halloween, this park became extra scary.
So there's a ghost everywhere mixed with the real, like, buildings.
The glasses are used in theme parks in China and Malaysia. With a processor inside, these augmented reality glasses are designed for ages 12 and up because of its weight and size. Augmented reality security glasses made by Beijing-based Gultan can be used by police to identify suspects.
He can set a blacklist and scan in a crowded people and find a criminal very soon.
Armed with facial recognition software, video or images captured by these smart glasses can be sent to security officials off-site for analysis. Of course, there are privacy concerns with any device that comes with built-in cameras, one of the reasons consumers rejected Google Glass. Still, the race is on for tech companies big and small to turn an everyday item like glasses into something smarter. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. Republican and Democratic presidential candidates may be dominating the headlines, but they are not the only ones running for U.S. president. What are known as third-party candidates have played a significant role in recent presidential elections. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on whether they could impact the upcoming election.
In the contest for the White House, it is well known that President Donald Trump is running for re-election as a Republican. And running against him is former Vice President Joe Biden, a Democrat. What is less well known is that there are other people running for U.S. president on other party tickets.
The Peace and Freedom Party, the American Independent Party, people really often don't know who these parties are.
People running for smaller parties are called third-party candidates. In the 2020 presidential race, two candidates from better-known third parties include Joe Jorgensen of the Libertarian Party and Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. Another third-party candidate who has made headlines is rapper Kanye West.
The most puzzling campaign, but the one that's gathered the most attention for his party, the birthday party. He's often talked about religion openly in his raps, and so he might appeal to more religiously conservative voters.
While third-party candidates are generally not considered serious contenders for the presidency, they can play a role in changing the dynamics of an election. One example is the 2016 race between Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton.
There's no question in 2016 that the third-party candidates hurt Hillary Clinton. All the exit polling showed that the votes that they were casting for third-party candidates were votes that otherwise would have gone to the Democrats.
2016 was a year in which there are a lot of Americans looking at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton weren't thrilled with either choice, and they cast one of these protest votes.
But experts agree the 2020 election is different.
It's very clear now that the stakes are so high that either Joe Biden or Donald Trump will be the next president, and nobody wants to throw their vote away. And so we're seeing those third-party candidates polling at a lot lower numbers.
Clinton may have lost some votes to third-party candidates in 2016 because of how some Americans viewed her. But Biden does not face the same perception.
Hillary Clinton was seen as a darling of Wall Street and of you know, high finance and these global trade deals that didn't give enough attention to the lives of working class people in blue collar jobs across America. I think Joseph Biden is from a working class background from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I think he can connect with that demographic even if he's associated with some of those trade deals.
The pandemic is also keeping third-party candidates from gaining traction in 2020 because it's tough for them to campaign in person. Third-party candidates also don't have the funds necessary to pay for big TV advertising campaigns.
The absence of third-party candidates that are strong this year should benefit the Democrats.
But as the outcome in 2016 proved, a presidential election can be quite unpredictable. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Social media companies are taking down videos and images that could be vital in prosecuting serious crimes. That's according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter are increasingly using artificial intelligence algorithms to remove material deemed offensive or illegal. Human Rights Watch says vital evidence is being missed or even destroyed. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The Russian missile launcher that prosecutors say was used to fire the weapon that brought down Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 in 2014. The videos were collated from social media sites by the organization Bellingcat, whose evidence was used by the multinational joint investigation team leading the criminal investigation. Russia denies involvement.
What we know from Bellingcat is at some point in the later stages of the investigation, they went back to look at the sources, some of the social media posts that they had used to substantiate their investigations in order to provide that to judicial authorities in the Netherlands. And at that point, the content had come down.
Evidence from social media plays a central role in many investigations, like these videos uncovered by Amnesty International, purportedly showing abuses carried out by the Nigerian army during its offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. In its new report, titled Video Unavailable, Human Rights Watch warns vital evidence is being deleted.
What we started to notice in the last few years, particularly since 2017, is that we would see a video of, let's say, soldiers executing someone or, you know, an ISIS propaganda video. And, you know, if 15 minutes later, an hour later, we went back to look at the video again, it was suddenly gone.
Social media companies told Human Rights Watch they are required by law to remove material that could be offensive or incite terror, violence, or hatred. As well as human moderators, many also use artificial intelligence algorithms to take down material.
Nowadays, these algorithms are so effective that they are taking down content the minute it gets posted. So no user ever actually gets to see that content before it comes down.
That includes law enforcement agencies pursuing criminal convictions. The International Criminal Court issued its first arrest warrant in 2017 based largely on evidence collected from social media for the Libyan commander Mahmoud al-Werfali, accused of murdering several captives. Civil society groups like Syria Archive are using social media videos to document potential war crimes, including the use of chemical weapons.
What we're calling for is the creation of some kind of global mechanism, sort of an archive or library.
Human Rights Watch says it is in dialogue with social media companies about creating such an archive. Twitter said it is unable to provide civil society organizations access to users' content without an appropriate legal warrant. Facebook and YouTube had not responded to Human Rights Watch or VOA requests for comment by the time of publication. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, since the coronavirus pandemic hit the United States, life has changed for most Americans. But the biggest change has been the shutdown of schools and universities. For many young people, the traditional ritual of leaving home to attend college has changed. Karina Bafrijian has the story.
The grown children of writer and columnist Mary Dell Harrington are living at home these days. When the pandemic hit, both her son and daughter decided to leave New York and stay with their parents in a large house in Georgia.
You know, we've all gone down the sort of COVID learning curve where we've sort of figured out how to coexist. It's made me more appreciative toward my children and the closeness that we have.
For some, moving back in with their parents is a choice, but for the overwhelming majority, it's a pandemic-inspired necessity due to job loss or closed university campuses. According to the Pew Research Center, the number of young Americans living with their parents has grown by over 2.5 million since the start of the pandemic. But experts say the pandemic has just accelerated a trend that was already growing.
It takes longer to get a job that is a long-term job than it used to. And you put all those things together, it makes sense that more of them would be living with their parents or moving back home with their parents.
23-year-old Yaroslava Zonova moved to the United States from Russia in 2017. She has been living with her parents since then. She says she earns enough to afford her own place, but believes it's easier to get through tough times surrounded by family.
I think that sometimes we stigmatize that living with your parents. I think sometimes we paint with this brush of like that being like a failure. And I really don't think it is, because oftentimes we just, no matter how hard we work, we're victims of our circumstance.
The trend is true among all ethnic groups, and it's hard to tell now whether that will change after the pandemic is finally over. Karina Bafrijian for VOA News, Washington.
The Cambodian government has allocated $1.2 billion to bolster an economy struggling with the withdrawal of some European trade perks and the COVID-19 pandemic. Luke Hunt has more from Phnom Penh.
Under its everything but arms policy, the European Union grants tariff-free access for goods from developing countries that meet international standards on democracy. But a ban on the main opposition party from contesting the 2018 election upset the EU, Cambodia's largest export market, prompting the withdrawal and an initial cost to business of about $130 million. Penh Kasal has worked at the Hung Hoa garment factory for the last 6 years. She says the EBA policy was having a dreadful impact on business amid layoffs, loss of overtime and reduced hours. She says she is now begging for government help. She is also in debt with the banks and finance institutions and adds this is why she is desperately seeking help. Hardest hit is the $7 billion garment industry, where about 700,000 workers earn $190 a month, producing for big brands such as Levi Strauss and Adidas. The Garment Manufacturers Association says the EU erred by withdrawing preferences on August 12 amid the COVID-19 pandemic, and that 450 factories have suspended work. It says another 83 have closed, hurting about 150,000 workers. Atit Kong is president of the Coalition of Cambodian Apparel Workers Democratic Union. He says the combination of EBA and the pandemic is costing jobs, and if the situation does not improve, then big brands might look for other countries to produce their garments.
I think the party need to work together to maintain and to keep this benefit for the country and especially for the workers.
But the plight of workers remains uncertain, and that is unlikely to change amid lost trade and the pandemic. Luke Hunt for VOA News, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Leaked documents allege that some of the world's biggest banks have allowed $2 trillion U.S. dollars worth of suspicious or fraudulent activity to take place, including money laundering for criminal gangs and terrorists. The so-called FinCEN files consist of more than 2,000 suspicious activity reports, or SARs, sent by banks to the U.S. Treasury, alerting the authorities to possible criminal activity from 1999 and 2017. The files were leaked to BuzzFeed and shared with a network of journalists. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The leaked documents allege that British banking giant HSBC transferred $80 million of fraudulent money via the US to Hong Kong, despite earlier warnings from United States authorities. JP Morgan moved $1 billion through a London account that it later discovered may have belonged to Semyon Mogilevich, a Russian mafia boss on the FBI's most wanted list. Deutsche Bank is accused of transferring dirty cash from money launderers with links to organized criminal gangs and terrorists. Standard Chartered and Bank of New York Mellon also appear several times in the leaks. All the banks involved say the cases are historic and say they fully comply with laws and regulations.
Most importantly, we have made huge investments in this sector since 2015.
So why weren't the transactions stopped? It's very difficult for banks to spot criminal activity, says financial crime expert Tom Keating.
The way I like to perhaps visualize this is, imagine you're standing on a street corner on Oxford Street in London, a major shopping thoroughfare, and someone says, right, you need to identify who either has just been shoplifting or who is about to go shoplifting. How easy would you find that? And this, to some extent, is what we're asking the banks to do.
Keating says the global system for reporting suspicious financial activity is not fit for purpose.
500,000 in the UK, several million every year in the United States of suspicious activity reports are filed by banks and others like accountants and so on. And what do those authorities do with all that data? They obviously can't look at every single one of those filings.
British politics is also under the spotlight. Lubov Chernykin, seen here next to then Prime Minister Theresa May in 2019, has donated $2.2 million to the Conservative Party. The leaks reveal her husband was secretly funded by Suleiman Kerimov, a Russian oligarch under US sanctions with close ties to President Vladimir Putin. Chernykin's donations were legal and fully declared under British law. Transparency International estimates $100 billion of dirty money passes through London every year.
If you want to launder dirty money, then the UK has all the tools you need. It has the law firms, it has the global banks, it has the offshore financial centres, it's got the real estate to invest your money in, it's got the private schools to spend your money on. And so we have to move faster on fixing the system, because right now the criminals have the upper hand.
Keating says despite the bank's claims, criminal financial activity is still happening on a vast scale, and governments and financial institutions must do far more to crack down. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. an 82-year-old Indian grandmother who became the symbol of resistance to a controversial new citizenship law passed last year that prompted widespread protest, has been named as one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people. The protest was cleared in late March after India imposed a stringent lockdown amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Anjana Pasricha spoke to her during the protest in New Delhi.
This 82-year-old grandmother, Bilkis, became the face of a months-long peaceful protest against a controversial citizenship law passed in India last year that critics say discriminates against Muslims.
There is no fight between Hindus and Muslims or Sikhs and Christians. Our struggle is against the new law. That's why I'm sitting here. Take it back and I will get up.
Ordinary Muslim women spearheaded the protest. Bilkis told VOA in January she would resist religious discrimination in a secular country.
We will not accept this law. This is a free country and that is how we want to stay.
Her fiery resistance at the protest prompted Time magazine to include her in its 2020 list of the 100 most influential people.
Till this law stays, I will come daily, whether for 2 months, 6 months, or 1 year. We're ready to face anything, beatings, stones, or bullets in our chest. We are ready. We will not budge.
India's stringent lockdown to contain the pandemic ended the protest after 101 days. But Bilkis, whose presence at the protest inspired many others across the country, remains a trailblazer. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. As journalists, we try not to become part of the story. Sometimes the story finds us. U.S. Agency for Global Media CEO Michael Pack is the first presidential appointee to serve in a new position created by Congress to modernize U.S. funding broadcasting efforts worldwide. Since taking charge in June, the U.S. International Broadcasting CEO has drawn bipartisan criticism for removing agency broadcasting chiefs and initiating a security review that resulted in some foreign Voice of America journalists losing their visas. VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, reports.
From Hong Kong to Belarus to China, 2020 has been a challenging year for a free press and access to information. But lawmakers mainly scrutinize the decisions of new U.S. International Broadcasting CEO Michael Pack, who ignored a congressional subpoena to appear and answer the committee's questions.
He is making a mockery of a U.S. agency that has long enjoyed strong bipartisan support. And he has shown tremendous disrespect for the committee, our committee, and its role overseeing USAGM. He's the wrong person for the job. He should resign, and if he doesn't, the president should fire him.
Pack is a former documentary filmmaker who has previously headed public and government broadcasting efforts. He testified last September he respects the news agency's editorial independence.
The whole agency rests on the belief that the reporters are independent, that no political influence is telling them how to report the news.
During his two-year-long confirmation process, Democrats alleged Pack had misused funds from his documentary production company, while Senate Republicans praised his experience. But Pack's decisions since taking charge in June have concerned lawmakers from both parties.
CEO Pack has ignored the will of Congress and withheld millions of dollars in funding from OTF. This is not a typical D.C. policy discussion. I believe his actions damaged support during the height of unrest in Hong Kong. Their tragic lack of support to freedom and democracy movements is also regrettable.
The Open Technology Fund, a group that uses U.S. government grants to promote internet freedom worldwide, is suing USAGM, alleging it breached its contracts by withholding $18 million in funds.
The goal is not to resolve evidence-based concerns, but rather to discredit OTF. More devastating, the agency continues to withhold nearly $20 million in congressionally allocated funds, forcing OTF to halt 49 out of its 60, or 80% of its ongoing internet freedom programs.
In June, PAC fired several executives in what Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey called a wholesale firing spree.
To date, more than 3 months later, no successors have been named to replace me or my counterparts at the other networks. Sadly, CEO PAC's arrival has brought only more chaos and uncertainty to U.S. international broadcasting. The turmoil could not come at a worse time. To be blunt, I fear we are falling behind our competitors in the information space.
USAGM has been criticized in a government audit for improperly conducting security checks on some of its journalists, an issue some Republicans praised PAC for addressing.
The reforms undertaken by Mr. PAC have undergone a significant amount of public scrutiny, as they should. But USAGM's poor vetting procedures over those last decades continue to threaten U.S. national security, and it's entirely the fault of those who mismanaged the process.
But one decision was roundly criticized by lawmakers from both parties. PAC ordered a security review that resulted in a failure to renew the J-1 visas of foreign journalists working at VOA.
We bring people here. We ask them to be honest and to speak truth to countries where speaking truth can get you killed, or at least imprisoned. Then Mr. Park denies their refuses to file the application to extend their J-1 visas, which means they're subject to deportation to the very place that we ask them to tell truth to a country where truth is illegal.
At least five VOA journalists have departed the country since their work permits expired, and as many as 20 more are expected to leave by the end of the year. PAC has defended its focus on security by suggesting being a journalist could be a cover for being a spy.
It's incredibly dangerous for the USAGM head to start basically writing the press release that the Kremlin can then turn around and use the next week about USAGM journalists.
In a letter to Chairman Engel, PAC said he could not appear before the committee due to a scheduling conflict and offered several possible dates for his testimony in October when the U.S. House is expected to be out of session. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the space weather forecasts for the sun could threaten how this report is both broadcast and watched. The next crew of the International Space Station moves closer to launch, and an asteroid the size of a school bus just missed hitting the Earth. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
Solar flares seen here by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory are weather events on the sun. El-Sayed Talat from the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration, or NOAA, says they are on the rise.
These are bursts of electromagnetic energy off the sun, and these can cause radio blackouts that can affect our emergency responders as well as our airline communications.
Space weather refers to electrically charged particles and radiation from the sun. It doesn't physically affect us on the ground, but it can affect our cell phones and GPS systems. Talat explains the large-scale effort to safeguard technology.
We have instituted space weather as part of the international, national, state, and local emergency management exercises. So So across the board, we're preparing for how we would respond to these large events.
The sun is entering a peak phase of flares called solar maximum. Solar radiation can be particularly dangerous to astronauts working outside in space. This week in Star City, Russia, the next crew of the International Space Station, or ISS, took their final pre-launch exams. NASA astronaut Kathleen Rubens.
There's many exciting things on this flight. First of all, it will be the 20th anniversary of the International Space Station while we're up there. We will have the first docking of the operational Crew-1 Dragon vehicle. And of course, we have many, many scientific experiments I'm looking forward to.
Rubens and two Russian cosmonauts are scheduled to launch from Kazakhstan October 14th. In other news, photographed here in satellite imagery, a 113-square-kilometer chunk of Greenland's ancient ice has broken away. New drone footage shows the melting ice that polar wildlife expert Tom Foreman says threatens the very makeup of the Arctic.
As the sea ice in this part of the world is retreating, it essentially means less habitat for feeding and reproducing for a large number of the species that live up here.
Foreman says melting ice endangers polar bears on down to plankton and algae. Researchers have yet to declare this year's sea ice minimum, but 2020 is expected to be the second lowest expanse in four decades of record keeping. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
With gyms closed and a lot of sports clubs not able to reopen, New Yorkers have turned to a new safe way of exercising. Dmitry Vershinin has the story.
Susan McNamara tried kayaking for the first time in 1996. Since then, she has paddled around Manhattan hundreds of times and once even traveled along the Atlantic coast of the U.S.
My biggest thrill so far is paddling around Manhattan. And one year we did that under a full moon. That's my most favorite and memorable paddle of all. Going out at 8 o'clock and just paddling under a full moon and coming back at 4 in the morning. And having the whole river to yourself.
Since the pandemic, McNamara says the Hudson has been a lot less crowded until lately. Closed gyms and restaurants have forced thousands of people to look for new, fun ways to spend their free time and stay fit. Amy Arkey is among those who tried kayaking for fun once, but fell in love.
At first, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Something was telling me that I just needed to come here and try it out. And then once I took the basic classes, I started from kayaking 1, 2, 3, 4, basics 1, 2, 3, 4. It just felt so good in the water.
Since that first class, Arkey has paddled to Statue of Liberty and even made her way to Coney Island to do some whale watching. That 50-kilometer long trip took her over 9 hours. Kayaking on the Hudson River is not a pastime for novices. It's more suitable for experienced and strong rowers. Twice a day, the current changes its direction thanks to the tidal curve. And if these changes are not taken into account, a kayak may be taken into the Atlantic Ocean in just half an hour.
You can do it!
Eric Stiller is the managing owner of Manhattan Kayak, the oldest kayak rental and tour company in New York City. His father started importing kayaks from Germany over 6 decades ago. Today, 59 years old, Eric proudly continues what his father started.
In kayaking, you're using a lot of core musculature, arms, shoulders, chest, and back. And believe it or not, you're using a fair amount of legs to push off the pegs inside of the kayak as well. So we create a dynamic where we're using our whole body.
In early summer, Stiller found out that New York City authorities labeled kayak rental business as essential, so he didn't have to close. He developed a set of strict rules that includes mandatory masks and hand sanitizers, but he didn't expect the wave of new clients that rushed to the store.
So all of a sudden, we found out people wanted to come and learn how to kayak and stand up paddleboard as a really great way to get out of their houses after 8 weeks and have a great time. So for us, we found that our demand increased a bit, but we had to match COVID safe with being able to register everybody online in limited numbers per hour.
The demand proved to be so great that for a while, kayaks were almost impossible to find in New York stores. But people like Susan McNamara, not surprised. After all, she discovered the magic of kayaking decades ago. Dmitry Vyshinin for VOA News, New York.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.